listening to KUCI 88.9 in Irvine.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this August 15th, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'll talk more about that later. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and as always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm pleased to be joined now by David McGlynn. David grew up in Houston, Texas, and right here in our own backyard, Southern California. A lifelong swimmer, he captured the national championship in the 500-yard freestyle in the 2001 United States Masters National Championships. He continues to compete in open water swimming races all across the country, and on most mornings is the first one in the pool. His story collection, The End of the Straight and Narrow, won the 2008 Utah Book Award and was named Outstanding Achievement by the Wisconsin Librarians Association. His stories and essays have appeared in Men's Health, The Huffington Post, Best American Sports Writing, and numerous literary journals. He teaches at Lawrence University in Appleton, Wisconsin, but it is his latest memoir, A Door in the Ocean, which is published by Counterpoint, that we will chat about that and other great subjects this morning. David, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
I hear you're a former anteater.
I am. I graduated from UCI in 1998.
That is fantastic. And you grew up in my little town. Well, you didn't entirely grow up in Laguna Beach, but you spent some time in Laguna Beach, my little town. It's fun to read about places that are in your own backyard. It's fun.
Yeah, well, you know, to say I spent time there is a bit of an understatement. My father and stepmother moved there in 1988 and still live there. So I've spent, you know, a great deal of time and did, you know, about half of my teenage years growing up there, and then of course came out, the moment that I finished college and lived there and went to UC Irvine and stuck around quite a lot. So it's a place that I love and I go back to whenever I have the chance to. Though lately it's been hard because I've got two young children and so forth, but it's a place I love very much.
That does put a damper on your fun travel, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it does.
Yeah, the town has changed a lot since 1988. It's gone through a lot of iterations, but it's the same great special place. I love it there.
Well, when we moved there, the Newport Coast Drive wasn't there. It was all orange groves up and over the hill, and to see that, you know, it's changed in the ways that it has is both sort of exciting but also sort of sad, those, you know, disappearing orange trees and the coastline filling in. But it's still a place of great beauty for me, and so one that I love to visit, but I also love writing about and thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. So let's back up and set the stage for the memoir. I'll let you introduce A Door in the Ocean, sort of the arc of the memoir, what it's generally about, and your decision to write it.
Okay. Well, you know, it begins with this sort of moment of incredibly explosive drama, which honestly took me a long time to come to terms with writing about. But when I was 15 and living in Houston, Texas, my closest friend was shot and killed along with his father and his brother in his home, in their home in Houston. And at the time, his mother and his sister weren't present because they were at swimming practice and were actually carpooling home with my younger sister. So in one of those sort of strange ways that family carpools work, you know, Jeremy and I had driven to and from our own practice together, and his mother and sister had driven with my sister to their other practice, and they weren't there. So it was a crime that took place in a really small amount of time. It was a family that my family was very close to. He was, like I said, my closest friend. You know, it was as close to this happening in my own family as I think I could have imagined. And it's a crime that remains, even 21 years later, unsolved. There weren't very many clues. Nothing much came of it, even in the initial couple days after the crime was committed. And, you know, as you might expect, a lot of the people who were touched by this crime, you know, go through some pretty hard things. And a number of the guys on my high school swimming team turned to, you know, violence and drugs and other various problems. For me, though, I go in a somewhat different direction, which is that summer after Jeremy dies, I come back to Orange County, to Laguna Beach, to spend the summer with my dad and my stepmom. And I find myself more than ever drawn into their religious world, which is evangelical Christianity, which, you know, is rather popular in Orange County. And that's been a world that I had been sort of sidling my way toward for the last couple of years. I'd been a teenager. My parents had been divorced. I didn't get to see my father all that often. And this is a world that I found sort of attractive. And once the murders happened, I was drawn in for good. And much of what the book, I think, is trying to circumscribe is how that religious world, how evangelical Christianity was attractive to me, how it offered answers to questions for me, how it filled a void for me that nothing else had been able to fill up to that point, and how it wasn't simply a matter of being, you know, as one might say, sucked in or brainwashed or whatever, but rather it was a series of decisions and attractions that sort of moved me toward this place. However, you know, as trajectories go, they sort of bend up and then they bend down. And as the story goes forward, I find that I'm not quite the fit for the evangelical world that I wished that I could be. And as the chapters go forward, I find myself increasingly at odds with the rhetoric and the language and the assumptions of some of the people I spend my time with. And so eventually, I have to make a decision about whether or not I'm going to continue on as a evangelical or not. And you can probably guess by the way I'm talking how that story kind of goes.
Right.
Along the way, you know, I go to Australia for a summer as a would-be missionary. I move to California, and then I move on again to Salt Lake City, Utah, where I meet a number of other friends, and I eventually meet my wife. And the story will eventually end just after I've arrived here in Wisconsin for my current job, when my wife's pregnancy with my second son becomes kind of all of a sudden troubled and problematic, and we worry that we're going to lose him. And I have to sort of reckon one last time with the sort of legacies of this faith that I had been thrust into, but also the legacy of the murder. And one of the things that was the hardest for me to write about, and in fact took years and several different versions of the story, was the ways in which the murder sort of trickles throughout my life and permeates my life and affects my life for years and years. For a long time, I thought that once I was sort of over the initial shock of it, and, you know, the first year or so had gone by, I was kind of done with it. I was kind of over it. I had moved on to just a regular life. In many ways I had. But as I was working on the book, I came to realize pretty forcefully that a number of the ways in which I saw and probably still see the world were affected by that one cataclysmic event that happens in the first couple pages of the story. And that's really, I think, the true legacy of what the story is about, how that sort of one singular act of almost incomprehensible violence sort of takes apart and reorders my entire way of thinking.
Right. Yeah, it's not, I mean, the event itself is horrific enough, but if it happened to you when you were 43 or 33 is a much different thing than I think it happening in those really formative years, because, you know, the time in which your life, where you found Christianity, evangelical Christianity, I think is such a, you know, murky time when people go into college and they're searching for something anyway, but an event like this to, you know, put a framework around that, trying to figure out, you know, how to fit that incredibly extreme event into, you know, some sort of order while your brain is still kind of wiring itself in those teenage years, I think is, ugh.
Well, yeah, well, I mean, absolutely, you know, and I mean, it happened at a time in which, you know, I'm trying to make decisions about who I'm going to be and what I'm going to believe in, and you know, and how I'm going to act, and you know, lurking in the background of all of this, which you know, the book I think makes pretty clear, is the fact that my parents' marriage had fallen apart a couple years before. So already there are these questions about, you know, what does love mean? What does commitment mean? What does faithfulness and fidelity mean? And then when the murders happen, it only exacerbates and amplifies those very questions. So, you know, that's exactly right, that to be 15 and to be, you know, sort of put forward into that world is a very different experience than to be 40 or 50. Though, you know, I suppose that you certainly can have an event that can happen when you are at almost any age, and it can, you know, affect the ways in which we see and unsee the world. And, you know, and ironically, a case in point in the story is my father. I mean, he and my stepmom get together when they're close to 40, and that's the sort of moment that my father's conversion to the same religious world takes place.
Right, right. Yeah, good point, good point. Was this a memoir you always knew you'd write, and you waited for the right time? It sounds like you were grappling with this for years and trying to figure out kind of the door into this story. Was this kind of something, even as a, you know, very young man in your early 20s, that you knew someday needed to be written about?
Not really at all. I resisted it for a long time. No, I can say that and qualify it. When I was a first-year graduate student at the University of Utah in Salt Lake City, I read first an excerpt of and then the whole book of Michael Gilmore's memoir, A Shot in the Heart, which is about his brother, Gary Gilmore, who was a very famous murderer back in the 1970s. And is also the basis for Norman Mailer's novel, Executioner Song.
Mm-hmm, right.
A lot of that story takes place, especially the final events, in Salt Lake City. You know, and at the time, I had sort of thought of Salt Lake City as, you know, kind of adherent to the cliches. It was kind of white bread or boring or whatever the case may be, the home of the Mormon Church. And reading that story completely rewired the way I thought about Salt Lake City and Utah, and then also nonfiction, you know, what creative nonfiction meant. So way back then, I sat down and I wrote, you know, what would become a very early version of the story of the murder, because I realized it was lurking back in there. And it was cathartic for me to do so. But I always thought of that story as one isolated story in my life. It was one sort of piece of a larger mosaic or a larger jigsaw. And as years went by, I was working on the End of the Straight and Narrow, the story collection, and every now and then I would come to some moment that would make me want to write nonfiction, and I would. And I would write what we might call a personal essay or a creative essay, usually organized around some kind of theme. You know, one time I wrote an essay about hunger, and another one was about you know, kind of feeling strange in your own body. Another one was about blindness. You know, these sort of topics were ranging. And I didn't think that I was writing a memoir. And in fact, the first couple versions of A Door in the Ocean were set up as essays, a kind of mosaic of different thoughts and topics. And it was only when, you know, I had a couple of editors and agents say, you know, this isn't really the right story that you need to tell. You need to go tell the story of how this murder has affected you and where it all connects, that I began to understand and to, you know, force myself to understand how how the murder really did permeate all the way through. Honestly, you know, I resisted the idea of writing a memoir. I'm in my mid-30s. You know, I felt like I hadn't really come to a point at which I had a memoir to write yet. I also didn't think that I had gone through something as big as one of those sort of, you know, grand political events or grand historical events. You know, I hadn't escaped from a war-torn country. I hadn't survived a personal act of violence. A memoir that I actually really love is another UCI memoir, Alice Sebold's Lucky, mm-hmm. Which is the book before The Lovely Bones. And I didn't feel like I had that kind of story, you know. It was only in reworking on the manuscript that I realized that I actually did have a story that wasn't that dissimilar. I did have a way of talking about this sort of big event and how it was a part of me, even in ways I didn't want it to be, but there it was. So it's almost like I had to do it, you know, in spite of my own resistance. But thankfully, you know, I come from a family full of Irish, stubborn, pig-headed people. And I just refused to give up. You know, I just refused to stop working on it. And even when I thought I could stop working on it, I would put it away for a while and then go back and have to do it again. You know, the fool who persists in his folly will eventually become wise. And I don't know if I became wise, but I at least got the damn thing done.
I do think it's interesting to put memoirs, novels too, but memoirs into the context of the world that they're kind of born into, you know, and the state of affairs of Christianity today, in today's society, evangelical Christianity, you know, we're on the brink of this next presidential election, and you can, you know, never discount the role of religion in these elections. So I do think it's interesting, sort of this memoir at this time for this society. You know, I am one of those people who go into religion sort of, you know, with a little bit of wall up. And I thought that one of the strengths and beauties of this memoir was your incredibly wise and kind of insightful, fair treatment of what the strengths are, what the weaknesses are, that you didn't buy into it whole cloth, that you, you know, came into it with a philosophical background, you know, in fact, a philosophy degree, and sort of, you know, looked at the subject objectively and not not from an issue, you know, not from a point of view of either extreme. And I thought that was really lovely. I think there's certainly a lot to be said for this memoir, but looking at the context of the time in which it came into the world, I think is also, you know, sort of bears talking about.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for saying that. You know, and it's fortuitous, I suppose, that, you know, this memoir gets published in an election year when, you know, religion kind of suddenly becomes this hot topic again, though I don't know if it ever really goes away. But, you know, one of the strange phenomena in book publishing is that there's this whole sort of shadow world of Christian publishing, and the shadow world is perhaps, it sounds too cloak and dagger. There's mainstream work that, you know, published by the sort of big presses, Random House and et cetera, that tries to think about sort of the religious landscape in America, the kinds of things that one might read on Salon.com or Slate or the places that I look at every day, which I think are, you know, balanced in their own right. And then we have presses that are specifically for and by Christians, you know, or religious-leaning people. And sometimes those two sides don't talk to each other all that well or all that often. And to be sort of even broader about it, oftentimes evangelical Christians especially are either portrayed by, you know, those who are unfamiliar with them as sort of overly zealous or out of touch or, you know, adherent to some kind of brainwashing or something like that. Whereas, you know, evangelical Christians who are writing about themselves or their own worlds will sometimes work a little too hard to erase the complexities and the frictions and the problems of it and show this world as better than all the rest. And you know, both sides in some ways are correct, and the caricatures are always based in some element of truthfulness. But I've never felt like that was the whole story. One of the sort of emotions that drives the storytelling for me is that feeling of a feeling weird, that I was a part of this world, I didn't totally fit within it, and yet I was committed to it, and I would feel like I somehow stuck out. And I would want to answer for myself, you know, how did I end up in this place, and how did I become this person? And that eventually became the impulse for a lot of the larger story. How does one become part of this world? What is inside of it? What informs it? And how is it certainly more complicated than it oftentimes gets portrayed? And I say this, you know, definitely keeping in mind the fact that evangelicals don't always do the best job of portraying themselves as complicated, or the truths of the world as existing within a complex context. I wanted to show that that wasn't necessarily the case, but then on the other hand, to also show that that their lives are just as complex, their psychologies are just as complex, their passions are just as multifaceted and layered as any other, even if their outward behaviors don't always look that way.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting that you sort of lump people in your brain, I mean, not you specifically, but anybody kind of, you know, and simplifies that whole group as here is their entire mentality, as opposed to, of course, it's made up of individuals who all have their own complex psychologies going on. And it struck me, the point in the novel that struck me, lots of them struck me, but when you announced to your stepmother that you were going to go into philosophy as a major, and she said, you know, be careful, because once you start thinking, that's sort of the danger zone of Christianity. And on the flip side of that, I think there was a philosophy major who was also an evangelical Christian who you went to school with, who was strengthened by his study of philosophy, that just, you know, served to strengthen his faith. So, you know, trying to group everybody into one category and call them all evangelical Christians and then make assumptions about how they all, you know, how everybody thinks in that category is a big mistake. And the memoir shed some great light on that.
Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, and my stepmother and, you know, that character in the story, whose name is Jake in the story, you know, actually worked for the same ministry, you know, so they weren't even from different sides of evangelicalism. They were from the same organization, the same body. And, you know, one was sort of anxious about the study of philosophy, and the other one was, you know, absolutely entranced by it and in love with it. We would have tremendous discussions about all kinds of things. And I owed a great debt of gratitude to both of them for different reasons. And I was hoping to point that out. You know, I hope that this comes across as a sympathetic portrayal. And, you know, you so kindly intimated that it was a few minutes ago. But that really is my sort of driving motivation for this aspect of the story, is to show that it's, you know, there's a reason to be compassionate towards people who sometimes don't always seem to square with the rest of the world.
Right.
And that for me, it's a project that I'm very much invested in.
You talked about this a little bit earlier, of this, category of Christian writing. And I was wondering if you give that any thought in your own mind, to being worried about or hoping to be classified as a Christian writer, or if that's something that, you know, the marketers and publishers worry about and you worry about your writing and you don't think about that part of it. How does that sort of genre play in your mind as to whether you want to be a part of it, you worry about it, or you don't even think about it?
Well, you know, I mean, to be totally honest, it is something I've worried about a lot over the years, largely because, you know, when you come up through some of these, you know, ministry organizations, I heard a lot of talk about, well, you could write for this, or you could write in this way, or you could write in that way, all of which were a way of saying that, you know, you could be a part of that Christian publishing, you know, world or empire or whatever the word would be. And I knew that was something that I didn't want to do. In fact, you know, a story that never made it into the book, though I flirted with it, is that one time I got invited to go to a men's retreat. This is right when I was getting close to the end of college, and I was starting to feel the most intensely that I really wasn't a good fit for this world. But I went up to this retreat, and this retreat center had a bookstore. And on a couple-hour break, I walked around this bookstore, and all the books were the sort of Christian press books about, you know, apologetics or Christian living or novels by Christians for Christians, etc. And because I was alone and it was a rainy afternoon, I found myself almost in tears, thinking that this was somehow the fate that I would have to choose. I would have to be like one of these kinds of writers. And the writing that I really loved was not anything like this. It was, you know, it was sordid, and it was strange, and it was dark, and it was Flannery O'Connor and Walker Percy and Don DeLillo and people who were sort of taking up some of the same questions, but were doing so in far sharper and far less sanitized terms. And about a year later, when I was back from Australia and I was working in Orange County, in fact, I worked for UC Irvine for a year before going off to graduate school. I was up in Los Angeles and I was proctoring an exam for the PSAT. This was one of my jobs at UCLA in one of their big lecture halls. And I had a book of stories that included Andre Debus's story, A Father's Story. And, you know, if you or, you know, our listeners haven't read it, they really ought to read it today. And in it, a Catholic father is sort of talking about his affection for his daughter. And at the end, he has this conversation with God where he speaks aloud to God and God answers him back. And I was so entranced by the story that I literally lay down on the floor at the front of this lecture hall at UCLA and just felt sort of hypnotized by it. And when I got up and I finished proctoring this exam and left the campus, I thought, this is the kind of writing that I have to do. And that story, and you know, it turned out there were others like it out there in the world, showed me that there was a way that I could write about faith, I could write about religion without becoming part of the Christian publishing, Christian fiction world. There was another conversation that could take place. And in fact, in Flannery O'Connor's book of what she calls occasional prose, Mystery and Manners, mm-hmm. she has a great line that says, you know, the prophet and the writer has to sometimes see the freak, which I've always taken to understand that you have to see those parts of yourself that are the strangest, and sometimes it's those strangest things that are the best fodder for narrative. And so I thought, I can turn into this. I can write about a world that other people find so befuddling. I can add my contribution to the cocktail party of literary conversation by shedding light on something that other people don't always know so much about. And it was writers like Andre Debus and, like I said, Walker Percy and Flannery O'Connor and Mary Gordon and, the list could go on and on, who gave me a real sort of shot of courage for how to go about doing that.
Yeah, well done. My guest this morning is David McGlynn. The book is A Door in the Ocean. It is his memoir. I'm hoping maybe you can read to us now. We'll take a short break so you can grab a breath of air and a glass of water or something, and then we can come back and talk about issues of craft and writing process and all those nitty-gritty issues. Does that sound like a good game plan for you?
Sounds good to me.
Okay, great. David McGlynn will read from his memoir, A Door in the Ocean, then we'll take a short break.
Should I read now? Or
yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, go right.
Okay, sorry, here I go.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm going to read from the second chapter. It's called The Open Door, and I wanted to read this because it's about swimming with my father in the ocean, which is easily one of my best memories in the world. And this is right as I'm sort of finding my way toward my father and stepmother's faith. And because this is, Irvine, California, or Laguna Beach, California, we're talking in Irvine, I feel like this would be an appropriate thing to read from. So, from The Open Door. My father and I swam in the ocean every night at dusk. If the swell was up, we surfed. I was comfortable in the water, and I learned quickly. And if the waves were flat, we snorkeled around the reef until we couldn't see the bottom. My father said, "Here," and I kicked down into the frigid depths to grab a handful of sand, proof that I had touched the bottom. No matter how far down I had to swim, how black and how cold, I had to touch the bottom. I learned to hold my breath when I was small by clinging to his shoulders while he dove toward the bottom of the diving well in our neighborhood pool, the shadowed gates to the pumps like a door in the earth's crust, a realm accessible only to him and to me. Now I felt I had to show my father I could go with him wherever he went, even to the bottom of the ocean. And I liked the seafloor, the pressure in my lungs, the rippled, untouched sand. Seeing the bottom emerge to the dark, I felt as though I was descending toward the surface of the moon. With fins and a good deep breath, I could go 35 feet. One warm night, I slipped out of the house and walked down to the beach to watch the lobster hunters. They cracked glow sticks and slid backward into the tide as their fins slapped the sand. The divers kicked along the bottom in groups of six and eight, pods of light trailing along the surface, marking their position and direction. I swam out with my mask and snorkel and hovered in their green light. The phytoplankton illuminated in a whirl around my head, and then circled down to the bottom to watch their sign language, their slow motion reaching into the tight crags and cracks of the reef. When I waved to one of the divers, his eyes bulged inside his mask. I imagined him telling his companions about me. Did you see the kid free diving with no wetsuit? And then his friends jabbing his ribs with their elbows. Sure, sure, a kid out here at 11 o'clock at night. Maybe you should lay off the compressed air, man. Until the diver himself began to wonder if I'd been only a hallucination. I surfaced and swam beyond the edge of the cove into the open ocean. The waves out there were rolling, big and shapeless. The bottom was a long way down. The coastline was lit up. All the lights from the houses and restaurants and street lamps and cars, all those lost souls, all those broken, blended, and misbegotten families, all ascending the hill like a giant wave pitching up to crash into the sea. All around me, phytoplankton glowed like stars in the moonlight. I felt I had entered a world unhinged from the laws of physics, without a floor or ceiling or sides. I felt like the door through time I'd been looking for last spring. If I dove to the bottom and touched the sand, I could return to last September and rescue Jeremy before it was too late. Except I didn't want to go back in time. I wanted to be right where I was, here in the ocean, away from all of it, offshore, unprotected, and alone. I can stop there.
That is fantastic. That was David McGlynn reading from A Door in the Ocean. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. We're going to take a very short break, let David take a breath, and we will be right back here for the entire hour. The second half will be chatting craft, process, relationships with editors, all that nitty-gritty writing stuff. So stay tuned. We will be right back.
Weekly Signals, the only weekly news commentary radio broadcast that features a dog named Molly. Weekly Signals with Nathan Callahan and Mike Kaspar. News with a bite. Friday mornings at 8 here on KUCI 88.9 FM. Radio that keeps on giving.
For a fresh alternative to your talk show routine, tune into KUCI 88.9 FM for the best in local public affairs programming in Orange County. And if you're behind a computer, listen online at www.kuci.org. KUCI, commercial-free programming since 1969.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at KUCI.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We are under College Radio. You can also visit Barbara's website, tripping over my words this morning, penonfire.com for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. We took the month of August off for our speaker series events, but we will pick back up in September, so be sure and check us out early. Those events always sell out pretty quickly, so you're going to want to get on the website, get your tickets ordered in advance, and make sure that you have a seat for that. They are always great events. I'm lucky enough to be joined by the entire hour this morning by David McGlynn. The memoir is A Door in the Ocean. We've been chatting in the first half hour about his the tragic execution style murder of his best friend in high school, and how that led him in part to evangelical Christianity, and his sort of grapplings with religion since that time. Gorgeous, gorgeous memoir. And so let's pick up with a little bit of craft issues. I wanted to talk, David, about structuring the memoir. A lot of these essays, I think, appeared independently in a fair number of magazines as essays on their own. I know the last chapter of the novel won an award for in a sports magazine. Is that, that's right, yeah?
It is. It was in the Best American Sports Writing in 2009. And you're right. Most of these chapters started out as discrete essays. I imagine that I was writing, you know, something akin to a short story collection. Only this would be a collection of essays, in which I was telling a series of stories about my own life. Creative nonfiction collections of essays were pretty big when I was in graduate school, and so I had a number of models that were, sort of guiding me and showing me that I could do such a work. And it was only over time that I let the collection morph into its current form, which is a memoir. And I will admit that it wasn't entirely something I just sort of evolved my way into. It took the sort of browbeating of a couple of agents and editors for me to finally come to terms with what the story had to be. And I have to give a lot of credit to the editor of this book, Dan Smetanka, at Counterpoint, who was just relentless with making the pieces of the story fit together. And he did really terrific work with helping me see how those pieces would work and helping it get all the way there.
Yeah, I was going to ask you at what point the memoir got to the editor, you know, kind of at what point it got sold and then got to the editor, and kind of the state of the memoir at that point and how much it changed. And if you were, it sounds like you were happy with those changes.
I was. It makes it sound, I make it sound like it was somehow in an uncompleted or unfinished state when it was sold. As I've already said, I thought of it first as a collection of essays, and I tried to send it out. I spoke with a number of agents about it as a collection of essays, and some said some really enthusiastic things, and I had some agents who said they were willing to take it on. But the ones who said that the smartest thing seemed to say it needed to move more toward the direction of the memoir. I tried it first quickly to change it from essay to memoir, and I thought I could just simply put everything in the chronological order, and it would be there. It's my life. I'm the I speaker throughout. What the heck? and it didn't quite go that way. And so, after a couple months, my first agent sent it out to a couple of editors who liked it but said they weren't going to take it. I made the sort of difficult decision that I needed to rewrite it. And so I rewrote it from the ground up, in which I took apart every chapter and stitched it back together again. And that included adding a couple of chapters that weren't there. It also included at the very end, and this really shocked me, was that I ended up cutting the first 50 pages. And if you're a writer, the first couple pages of any story or any narrative are pages that you feel like have, you're really close to, because you live with them for so long. It's not the filler. It's the launching pad for the entire story. So the fact that I had 50 pages that I felt like needed to come out, and needed to come out when I thought I was almost finished with the story, was for me very difficult. But I did. I took it out. My wife gave me the suggestion that I could take those pages out and the story would survive. And I did, and so I thought I had, what was ultimately finished product. And in fact, I asked the editor of the book of stories, Catherine Lang, who was just in retiring from SMU Press, if she would take a look at it. And so she read it, and we talked about it, and she performed some of her editorial magic on the manuscript. And then I handed it over to my agent, and she sent it out. And it was lucky enough to land with Dan Smetanka at Counterpoint. And he said initially, and I'll rib him a little bit if he ever listens to this, that
we were
there
trying to get him on this morning, but
We had everything pretty well locked down. It was pretty polished. We could just do a little bit of sort of spit and polish work. And then once we got going, he said, well, now that we're here, let's try this, let's try that. And he had me rewrite the beginning again. And that first chapter, Good People of the World, went from being about 20 pages to close to 40. A number of the other chapters expanded and contracted in various ways. And over the course of about 10 or 12 weeks, we added another 70 pages and took away probably about 30 pages, all of which I found increasingly and incredibly difficult because I thought I was finished. And when you feel like something is finished, you feel like you have it there. You know, you want to put the sculpture on the shelf. You want to stick it away and sort of stand back and admire it. And I kept finding all these flaws that I had to go back and deal with. Which was hard, but it is in the end just how the process goes. So, you know, this is a long way of saying, I suppose, that it went through a number of very different versions before it ended up at the final resting place. And it really wouldn't have gotten there without the sort of smart, sharp eye of the editor that I had. And maybe this is a roundabout way of making a plea for good editors to keep their jobs and for good presses to continue to employ good, thoughtful, sensitive editors who are willing to sort of read and work with writers, which is sometimes becoming a scarcity in a number of presses these days.
Right, right. Yeah, in fact, we were trying to get Dan to come on with us this morning and talk about it, but he's on vacation, so we'll let him
have his
well-deserved time off. Ah, well, you know, it's funny to hear you talk about it being a series of sort of disconnected essays that then gelled into a memoir because, you know, there's this really lovely water motif that runs through it from both, you know, it comes at it from both angles, from obviously your swimming background, from sort of the baptism background of religion. A lot of the chapter headings, though not all, you know, hint at water. It certainly plays a big role throughout. And so it was funny because my impression in reading it was that, oh, you know, David must have started out with this water image that then kind of framed and shaped the entire writing of this. But it sounds like these were all independent and then, you know, kind of stitched and worked together in the aftermath. So perhaps the water motif came later.
You know, the water motif was probably in the middle, I would say. You know, once I started to understand that this could be a book, you know, I started casting about for those connections that would help it hang together. Now, you know, I wasn't so naive as to think that there didn't have to be some connection between what I had originally thought of as discrete essays. I knew I wasn't working on something that was completely scattershot. And so once I began to see how the pieces might try to relate together, the watery metaphors immediately began to show themselves. The original title for the book was Rough Water, which was the title of the essay that had been in the Best American Sports Writing. And I was trying to think along those lines, the ways in which water was sort of playing a part. So, you know, there's the chapter Hydrophobia, which comes pretty late in the story. And that, too, was an original essay before it was a chapter. And there are all the ways in which I'm stressing out about, you know, water pipes leaking in my house. The real concern, though, the real water that shows up for me in that chapter is my wife's amniotic fluid when that pregnancy becomes imperiled. And we have to go through an amniocentesis. And watching that amniotic water, you know, as we talk about it in the sort of jargon of baby having, you know, what would later break her water breaking, the amniotic water. That became something that I was, you know, most concerned with. And even as I wrote that original essay and was writing that scene at which the amniocentesis was taking place, I realized that that was a point of connection. And then, you know, as the iterations of the book went forward, it became a motif that I amplified and enlarged until it was showing up, you know, ever more prominently. So even in those, you know, those bits of the book in which I'm seemingly far away from water, you know, like in the chapter Wandering in Zion when I'm hiking in the desert, water is a concern because we're out of water. We need drinking water. We've been hiking along a dry riverbed. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's either there in presence or in absence. And this is really how I think books come together. You see those things that are possible joiners of the various girders of the story, and then you work your brains out to see if you can get those pieces that actually fit together.
It's interesting to do that in because it's interesting to do that in a novel, but doing it in your own life, I wonder if this shed some sort of light on what you had gone through in a new way, having to go through and shape it as an arc of a story rather than as events that happened to you. And, you know, in seeing the ways water is played out, you would only go through that exercise if you were writing about it in, you know, sort of a narrative arc.
It absolutely did. And that's the thing. I mean, this is the difference between, you know, living one's life and writing about one's life. You know, my life is certainly, and I hope every reader sort of understands that going in, has more pieces to it than just the 262 pages of the story. You know, there are people that don't show up and events that aren't narrated and et cetera. But when you sit down to write about your life and you have to organize the various components into some kind of an order, you have to find those ways that are making the connections. So, you know, I can return again to my little anecdote about the amniocentesis and my wife's amniotic water. In the revision of the story, you know, where that had first just been, oh, here's a way in which David's talking about writer, or about water. When I went back and revised the manuscript, I realized, no, it's more than that. It's not just another instance of water in the abstract. This is drawing a direct connection between the fears that are produced by Jeremy's murder and the fears about what are happening now that I'm in my 30s and a father and a husband. And it was very much seeing how water was, you know, that sort of river running between those things, to, you know, pun a bit too much, that helped me to understand those connections. It sounds like it's a disordered process, and I suppose it's only fair to say that it absolutely was. I mean, I was constantly swimming around back and forth trying to make these pieces fit together. But when the water would show up, I would pay attention, you know. And I suppose it's also fair to say that I'm someone who's just fascinated by water. I'm drawn to it. I like to be by it. When we want to go on vacation as a family, I always want to go to where there's water, never to anywhere else. And when I moved to Salt Lake City, for example, you know, learning that the entire Salt Lake Valley had once been a vast inland ocean or lake, and you can still see that water line around the mountains in the city. That was something I was just naturally drawn to because I'm drawn to water anyway. And so thus it started to show up in the story and became yet another way that I could connect the dots.
Right. I was wondering if your swimming life and perhaps your grapplings with religion, apart from content in your work, impacts your work in other ways, impacts your writing in other ways. So, you know, if swimming provides a discipline, provides a, you know, long-term goals, whatever it is about writing that swimming might help you with.
Well, you know, I mean, again, like, absolutely is the right answer. That, I mean, one of the things that swimming gave me all the way through high school and college and then beyond was this ability to trudge forward in something that I didn't always want to do. You know, and swimming in college, and swimming competitively is hard. You know, we were in the water 4 hours a day, 2 hours in the morning, 2 hours at night. We had to lift weights. We had to go to a study table. I felt like I was always traveling with the team to compete in one meet or another. And that often meant that I would wake up in the morning at 5 a.m. and look at my roommates, and we would grudge and crawl out of bed and move ourselves exhaustedly to the pool. And even when I didn't want to go, I would go, just because it was that thing that I was obligated to do. And in a lot of ways, you know, I went through periods in which, you know, religious faith certainly felt like that when I was going, just because I felt like I had some abject obligation to it. As a writer, ironically, that has been the very ingredient that has given me the discipline to stay with it. And I try to approach my work as a writer in much the same way that I approach my life as a swimmer. The alarm goes off, you go and you sit there and you do it. And even if you feel like garbage or you're tired or you don't want to or you just simply feel uninspired, it doesn't matter. Go and do it every day, come hell or high water, and eventually I'll make progress. I hope that doesn't sound, you know, overly puritanical.
No, that is what
I just try to be stubborn, you know. And every now and then, in the same way that, you know, every now and then you wake up and you're supposed to swim and you don't, and you say, okay, that's it. You know, this is the one day out of 100 I'm going to bail. You know, I'm certainly smart enough that I've taken a break here and there. But when I'm engaged with a piece of work, I try to just go to it every day and count the struggle and the failure as part of the eventual success of it. Because I'm not someone who thinks very productively away from the page. I tend to do my best thinking and dreaming when I'm sitting at my desk with a piece of paper and usually a pen. I tend to write by longhand more than on the computer. And even in those days when I'm stuck, I still feel like I'm moving my way through something. I'm still attacking the problem. I suppose now, you know, as a swimmer, since I no longer compete at the same level that I used to, or I no longer have the same concerns about whether or not I win, you know, even a bad day of swimming I can count as a pretty good thing, because it meant that I am, you know, burning calories and, you know, getting my joints to loosen up, and I'm enjoying the company of the other people that I swim with, and et cetera. And I try to think of my writing along the same lines. Even if the day turns out to be, you know, a huge failure, at least I'm there. And eventually, the failure will turn into something that I can use. And I have found more usable nuggets in things I thought were throwaways than I can even begin to enumerate. I mean, it's just, it's amazing to me how I go back to old pages and think, oh, look at this, I can make something out of that. And for that reason, I go back to the page day in, day out.
I love that. That's great, great advice. We're drawing down on our time. My guest has been David McGlynn. The book is A Door in the Ocean. I have to ask on one quick question on vetting the manuscript, letting people, you know, sort of have their bite at the apple before you published it. Was there any sense in people you were worried about? I don't know if you've spoken with Jeremy's mother in the aftermath of this, how your stepmother and company have been happy about it. Tell me a little bit about whether you felt the need to vet the manuscript before it being published, or if that was not a concern.
Yeah, you know, that's something I can certainly talk about. Jeremy's mother unfortunately passed away in 2004, largely, I think, from grief. You know, I don't think that she ever really was able to recover from what happened. His sister and I, his younger sister Becky and I, are still in touch on a sort of now and again basis. And I did ask her if she was okay with me writing about this. And I'd shown her she'd seen some early versions of a smaller portion of the story that concerned her brother. And she was okay with it. She said it was okay. I didn't vet the entire manuscript with her, but I did, you know, make sure that she was okay with me writing about all of this. And then I did really worry, and in fact, I still really worry about how, you know, my dad and my stepmom will or would receive the story. And in some ways, I'm ashamed to say that I don't talk with them about it a whole lot, because I'm a little bit afraid of what that conversation would be about. And I know they're proud of me for having written the book, and I know they're proud of me for what I've accomplished, but you know, in a lot of ways, I can say that I wrote the book for my, you know, to explain to my dad and my stepmom how I got to be the person that I am, and why, you know, why my faith is no longer the same as theirs. I didn't, however, vet the manuscript with them. I didn't send it to them and say, please read and let me know what you think. I just went for it. And I had this conversation with a number of my friends who are writers. Deborah Monroe is a writer that I'm very close with, and, the sort of great poet and essayist Thomas Lynch visited my campus, and he and I talked about it, too. And they all said, you know, you got to just do it. It's your story, and it's your life, and you got to just tell the story.
Yeah.
And so I did. But that doesn't mean that I haven't spent a lot of sleepless nights pacing my house and asking God for forgiveness for the ways in which people might read or perceive the story. I do hope that, you know, I have painted, you know, at least a balanced and sympathetic picture. I did change the names of some people who I felt like I might be a little harder on than, you know, I might otherwise be inclined to be, just to sort of provide some protection for their privacy. But, you know, to my great good fortune, most of the people who have read it, even those who were in the story, have said kind things about it, and that's been a great relief for me. I haven't had the sort of blowback, at least not yet, though I suppose it could still be coming.
I don't think so. I don't think so. It was incredibly generous, fair, and I mean, my read of it is people would be delighted to be included. David McGlynn, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the full hour this morning. I really, really appreciate your time and flexibility, and the memoir was fantastic.
Well, it was a great privilege for me, so thank you very much for having me on.
Thanks again. That was David McGlynn. The book is A Door in the Ocean. It's published by Counterpoint. It is out and available now. That's all the time we have for. I will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. So until next time, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.